Hello, I'm Brett Dillon, and this is The Movie Chronicles. This episode hits the sweet spot of superheroes in the swinging 60s. Prepare to be dazzled by derring-do, marveled by mirth-making, and dominated by drivel. Yes, holy Hannah, it's Batman the Movie. Director, Leslie Martinson. Script, Lorenzo Semple Jr. Director of Photography, Leslie H. Martinson. Editor, Harry Gerstedt. Music, Nelson Riddle. Actors, Adam West, Burt Ward, Lee Merriweather, Cesar Romero, Burgess Meredith, Frank Gorshin, Alan Napier, Neil Hamilton, Stafford Rep, Milton Fromm, William Dozier, and Monty O'Grady. In the 70s, the Brits turned their TV series into a movie adaptation genre, which became an art form to help keep the British film industry alive. In the USA, they were more into commercial imperatives, maximizing return from investment. Batman the Movie helped to pioneer the TV series to movie transition, and is still as much fun as when it was first released. A US camp classic which must be seen to be believed. The high, or is that high, point for me was the Bat Shark repellent spray. The Batman TV series of the 60s has become a camp classic. At the time, it was only a slight exaggeration of the comic book. Bat Cow, anyone? The movie combines the four main villains, Penguin, Riddler, Joker, and Catwoman, in a plot to take over the world. Of interest to me is that the kapow blam inserts during the fight sequences in the TV series don't appear in the movie until the climactic fight. This allows a clearer look at the fight choreography. It's pretty slick, albeit bloodless, bruiseless, and consequence-free. The script struggles to incorporate all the features of the TV series into the movie. I'm thinking particularly of the clumsy use of the bat signal and the climb up a building featuring a cameo roll head through a window. The film version allows for more location shooting, although it is clear the director is very uncomfortable with this. If you prefer your Batman to be less happy, there's always the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight version to watch. If you prefer your Batman to have a gay old time, then this is the Batman for you. Clear out the tent pegs, we've had enough camp for the moment. Some superheroes were more, how shall I say it, sophisticated? If Batman belonged to the don't say gay school, then I'm telling you, this film never went to that school. Modesty Blaze. Director, Joseph Losey. Script, Evan Jones, Harold Pinter, and Peter O'Donnell. Director of Photography, Jack Hilliard and Davis Bolton. Editor, Reginald Beck. Music, John Dankworth. Actors, Monica Vitti, Terence Stamp, Dirk Bogarde, Harry Andrews, Clive Revel, Michael Chow, and Michael Craig. Modesty Blaze is a mess, and not surprising really when you consider the troubled production. Modesty began life as a comic strip featuring master criminal Modesty and her sidekick, Willie. In her backstory is her escape as an amnesiac from a displaced persons camp in Greece in 1945. She trains under Jewish scholar Loeb, who gives her the name Modesty. She chooses her own last name, Merlin's tutor from the Arthurian cycle of tales, but also a nod to philosopher Blaise Pascal. In 1953, Modesty takes control of a criminal gang in Tangiers and expands it into an international organization called the Network. Here she meets and mentors Willie, the only man she trusts. Modesty gains British citizenship by marrying James Turner. He dies a year later. Modesty settles in Britain and goes straight. Bored of the life of the idle rich, she is quick to take up the offer of Sir Gerald Tarrant to work for the British Secret Service. This offer is the basis of the comic book series. Peter O'Donnell's comic had a certain gritty reality that director Joseph Losey ignored. Peter was later to recount that the only line of dialogue retained from his original script was, "What do you know about Wilberforce?" From the success of the James Bond series, director Joseph Losey wanted to branch out and do a pop art-inspired satire of the spy movie craze. As a result of this choice of style, Peter O'Donnell was not Joseph's biggest fan. This was not the only on-set problem. Modesty Blaze was actor Monica Vitti's first English-language film. She brought onto the set Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni, who directed her performance until Joseph, politely of course, directed him off the set. Actor Dirk Bogarde was not a fan of Monica, describing her as beastly on the set. The mess for Terence Stamp was actually not directly involved with this picture. He turned down the starring role in the movie Alfie to appear in this film. The role went to his flatmate, Michael Caine, who became a major star on the back of its success. On a side note, production was begun in 1965 with the idea of getting Michael to play the part of Willie. And now I can return to the mess that is this film. Being kind-hearted by nature, I still find the best I can say is that Modesty is a dry run for the adaptation of the French comic book character Barbarella, 1968. That will be, to many minds, damning with faint praise, so I should clarify that I actually enjoy how messy Barbarella is. I do not enjoy the messiness of Modesty, because it never really commits to being camp, or a comedy, or a spy film, or a caper film. It never commits to anything in the final analysis. It is whatever it needs to be in the moment, which can work under careful direction. In this film, the moments just don't work. The swinging 60s of this film begins when a British agent is blown up in Amsterdam with a booby-trapped doorbell. He was working on a case to allow diamonds to be used to purchase oil rights in the Middle East. Master criminal, Gabriel, wants to hijack the jewels before the transaction is made. The Secret Service call in Modesty Blaze because of her underworld connections. At the start of the film, Gabriel is rumored to be dead. This is a plot point dropped almost as soon as said. If it's supposed to be a secret that he's still alive, it isn't a very well-kept secret. With the arrival of Modesty, we come to the real problem with the film script. Like Barbarella, she is a very passive character in her own narrative. Willie does all the work, she gets all the credit. The central section of the film involves her being captured and Willie or someone else freeing her. Modesty is supposed to be the hero, a mastermind, a master thief, etc. Yet she is portrayed as helpless whenever she is alone. The expectation raised on her introduction that she is the smartest one in the room is all undone by what follows. Very early in the picture, you question why the Secret Service would hire a bozo like this. Joseph Losey tries to disguise this with style over substance and tonal shifts that veer all over the place. You need to fight back the gag reflex over how bad the finale is, where the tone swings between a thriller and a Hollywood epic comedy, i.e. not funny at all because ill-thought and undeveloped gags are performed by stars mugging to their fans. The film is so light that the principal theme, at least to me, is wigs. You'll need to see the film to understand that reference fully. The wigs are transformative objects on the actors, making them older or younger, or to make them look like their comic character until it is revealed that is not what this film will do, or the opposite reveal in which the character switches from not looking like their comic version to reversing back. Audiences were lukewarm on a film that managed to insert a love duet in the middle of an escape attempt. This is not a musical. Critic Bosley Krauser got the audience tone just right when he wrote, "A weird film. Maybe if the whole thing were on a par with some of its flashier and wittier moments, or were up to its pictorial design, which is dazzling, it might be applauded as a first-rate satiric job." Now, in this next film, you might think I'm pushing boundaries, but let me tell you, any ghost that can pull off the fashion faux pas of an invisible bikini is a hero to me, not to mention any actor whose career survived this film. The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini. Director, Don Weiss. Script, Louis M. Haywood and Elwood Ullman. Director of Photography, Stanley Cortez. Editor, Fred R. Fishans Jr. and Eve Newman. Music, Les Baxter. Actors, Tommy Kirk, Deborah Wally, Aaron Kincaid, Quinn O'Hara, Jesse White, Harvey Lembeck, Basil Rathbone, Patsy Kelly, Boris Karloff, Susan Hart, Nancy Sinatra, Francis X. Bushman, Benny Rubin, and George Barrows. Invisible Bikini was a troubled production, which in part explains why it is considered the last of the beach party genre, even though none of the action occurs on a beach. It was originally offered to distributor AIP as The Girl in the Glass Bikini. AIP was not impressed, and added footage involving Boris Karloff and Susan Hart. Even before that, the production was troubled. Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello were originally intended to be the stars. Frankie wanted to be in more serious productions, and Annette wanted to spend more time with her family. Buster Keaton was cast as Chicken Feather, but he died before filming began and was replaced by Benny Rubin. Tragedy pursued the film post-production. In 1966, and within the same month, actor Philip Bent died in a plane crash, and Bobby Fuller died in his home. There is a rumour that he was murdered. The only substantive connection to the early films in the Beach Party series is the appearance of the Rat Pack motorcycle gang, who are underused in the film, and spend most of the running time wondering why they are even in the movie. Of more note is the appearance of the progeny of famous people who make appearances. Nancy Sinatra, daughter of Frank Sinatra, is there, alongside Claudia Martin, daughter of Dean Martin. The pop group performing poolside is the Bobby Fuller Four. Recently departed promoter Hiram Stokely specialized in circus acts. His one great love was Cecily, a trapeze artist known as the Girl in the Invisible Bikini, who passed on some 30 years earlier in an, unfortunate accident. She appears to Hiram to guide him through the afterlife. Her instructions are not very encouraging. He must perform a good deed in the next 24 hours, or he won't get to heaven. Nor can he leave his crypt to do the deed. Cecily offers to help. After careful thought, Hiram decides his deed will be to protect his heirs from the wiles of his lawyer, Reginald Ripper. The heirs are Chuck Phillips, Lily Morton, Myrtle Forbush, and Ripper himself. Only the heirs that hear the reading of the will get a share of the estate. Myrtle arrives with Bobby and his teen friends, who quickly set up a pool party. Reginald Ripper has bought J. Sinister Hulk and his team of assassins, Yolanda and Chicken Feather, to make sure he is the only one at the will reading. Knowing nothing about the existence of Bobby, he encourages his daughter, Sinistra, to seduce and kill him. To add to the mix, Eric von Zipper, leader of the Rat Pack motorcycle gang, sees and falls in love with Yolanda. He and his gang follow her to the creepy mansion where the will be read. Hiram and Cecily have their work cut out for them among all the mayhem, and then Yolanda's pet gorilla gets loose and, well, you can forget the plot from then on. I did. It would be easy for me to sneer at this film. I won't. I'll leave that to critic Margaret Harford, who wrote, The Girl in the Invisible Bikini has little to distinguish itself from its predecessors beyond the rumor that this beach party romp in a haunted house will be the last in AIP's long proliferating series. Tommy Kirk plays eye candy, even though his character has been usurped in the script by that of Bobby. Chuck only comes into his own at the finale fight sequence, and even then just barely. Cecily's invisible bikini is just that. See-through. You can see right through it to the background. Her character is also problematic. She says she's there to help Hiram to heaven. When the plot gets going, she does little beyond watching and occasionally haunting, rather than helping. You really question why the character is in the film at all, as the other characters seem to be doing fine within the original script. At last, we return to the same bat time and same bat channel, but not the same battiness, with the ripped off the wild, wild world of Batwoman. Also known as the wild world of Batwoman, also known as She Was a Hippie Vampire. Director, script, and editor, Jerry Warren. Director of photography, William G. Toriano. Actors, Catherine Victor, G.J. Mitchell, Steve Brody, Richard Banks, Steve Conti, and Bruno Visotta. This is a film that's not so much wild as woeful. Packaged to cash in on the Batman TV series, it also robs from the Dick Tracy series and the Beach Party films, but its major reference is the movie serials of the 30s and early 40s. From the late 40s onwards, the serials became more sophisticated than this film seems to be able to muster. How cheap is this film? Let me count the ways. The film was sued by DC Comics for copyright infringement, leading to the film getting a name change. Most of the Batgirls were workers at a strip club shut down by the police. The casting director waited outside the club and offered them jobs. Actor Catherine Victor had to create the Batwoman costume herself because director Jerry Warren wouldn't hire a costume designer. As an aside, to put it politely, Jerry Warren seems to have been a vindictive bastard if reports of what he got up to on set are true. The plot of this excretion needs to be handled with rubber gloves to prevent permanent staining. Batwoman is a superhero who has a troop of Batgirls at her command, with the lesbianism being implicit, albeit totally uncoded. They communicate via Dick Tracy-style wristwatches. Her nemesis is Ratfink. He's after the atomic hearing aid, developed by the Ajax Corporation. This plutonium-powered device, invented by Professor G. Octavius Neon, allows for unlimited eavesdropping. The professor's lair has hand-painted dials on the machine and is the parody of a set. It represents something that is meant to represent something else. It's a hasty sketch of what a laboratory might look like if the budget existed to create it. Ratfink wants to steal this hearing device. Batwoman is hired to stop him. Being a master detective, Batwoman utilizes a seance to get information. We also get stock footage from The Mole People, 1966, the best scenes from that particular film. This ends my review of the woefully wild world of Batwoman. Next episode is devoted to Buzzsprout and Patreon supporters only, although I remind listeners the individual episodes are available for sale from Patreon. This will cover Sergei Eisenstein's two-part epic, Ivan the Terrible. When you download an episode from your podcast provider, don't forget to leave a useful comment, something like, "The drinks are on the house." Which reminds me, if you're not a pod person, the next episode takes us to Australia. Practice the Australian wave or get used to eating fly sandwiches, which are a very different thing from the tasty treat, a fly cemetery. Purchase Movie Chronicles 1960 and Disney and the Groovy 60s at an e-store provider near you. And don't forget, the Bridge to Nowhere does actually exist. That's a teaser for a coming episode.